I don't think so.
Okay. All right, we're talking about your early experience as a special assistant. What in situations were if you disagreed with him based on your experience, how would you go about expressing those views to him, and how did he respond to them?
I think everybody has a different experience. I would simply tell him on the basis of what I thought the fact situation to be. And generally, these were situations where it involved in conversations and interaction with other people, how I thought they would react, they would view the situation. And I may be wrong, I may be right, but this is what I think. And he would, in some cases, say, well, I believe. So, well, all I'm telling you is this is what I think, and I'm prepared to do whatever you suggest doing based on your ultimate decision as to which way to go. And these would involve organizing efforts. They would involve political campaigns. They would involve a host of things that he thought important enough to bring everybody together around. He used to have a process where he'd bring all of the principal staff together once a week, twice a month, and do what we call a sort of around the country analysis of what's going on and how that played into any direction and policy that we were going to be taking on. And everyone, because of the different responsibilities, obviously talked to and interact with different people. And only a few of us interact with a much broader group. And so the views of everybody come from many different perspectives. And that's why I say if you came to the meeting unprepared, it wasn't long before you knew about it, because he himself also kept track as best he could of all of these issues and all of these situations. And talked to many people, some of which you may have talked to also. So it was an effort to bounce ideas around and thoughts and stuff. And I think it helped to build a collegial relationship between staff. But it also, it was tough on people from time to time.
Was this, in effect, a regular scheduled staff meeting, or was this just dealing with issues?
It was issues, but on a scheduled basis. It was what we used to call the national issues, sort of roundup. I mean, what's going on out there, how do we relate to it? Part of this 64 change was that the National Union would be available to assist any affiliated whenever and however it could, and that we would not be an organization in Washington, D.C., 10 phone calls away, but would be available to give assistance. And in order to do that, he believed that we needed to keep on top of the issues that were principal issues in virtually every sector of the country. People did. I mean, he made you read reports. He insisted that you read, current articles. He insisted that you read the newspapers. it became habit forming. Two people can read the same article and come away with a different perception of what was meant. And that there are always nuances. New York is different than Cleveland, Ohio. And he took a great interest in all of these differences.
At that time, did you or anyone else have to serve the function of listening to staff members, key staff members, who either didn't agree with Jerry or didn't understand Jerry or wanted advice on how to deal with Jerry? He was a very
I think the executive assistant to the president plays that role. How's he doing today? What's his feeling? Is he okay? Part of the executive assistant's role is to counsel with department heads And you had to have a sense of the kinds of things that Jerry wanted you to be clear about, so that it would help with his decision-making process. You had to counsel with him on most things that are priorities. I mean, you don't want to hear about everything, but you want to make sure that if everything is going to get discussed, these are the things that you ought to focus more attention on. These were part of the responsibility. You had to read the departmental reports prior to a board meeting, so that if there were clinkers, I mean, you know, folks had to deal with that. If certain segments of it was not given as much, you know, weight as others, maybe you want to rework this so that you make sure the board understands what's going on. There may be some that you want to talk to him about before you set it to writing. And I think the executive assistant's job is to sort of work with the other staff people to do that, not to insert your own opinions about what it ought to be.
Right. Now, this is the responsibility you had, did you enjoy this type of a relationship with the staff? It isn't the easiest one, as you
know. I would have to say I was only doing it for a short period of time. It may have been better or worse over the long haul, but I was there for a couple of years, and it was okay with me. Now, I'm very clear that he had personal relationships with staff and principal staff that he enjoyed outside of the structural relationships, and I was always mindful that you can't and should not cut those lines, because you're destined to failure if you do.
Did you have to travel at all in this new assignment? Travel even with Jerry?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was, as I said before, a golden opportunity for me, because as the executive assistant, you got access to a lot of different meetings and engagements that was pretty heady, you know, stuff for a young fellow from California. Whether it was meetings with presidents or principal leaders of the American labor movement or business or academia. I mean, yeah.
Now, today, you have a reputation of being a very effective speaker, one that I've heard a lot about. Now, what was when you first had to go out and speak to public groups like this, either in California or after you took on these new responsibilities, even in a situation like Detroit, or how did you find that experience?
I'm always, you know, a little leery of addressing, you know, a large group or a small group, but I think I sort of lean on what I call the steward's prayer, you know, where one or more of you have gathered together, I'll come among you and give a speech. I think the issue is, you know, what are we trying to get across? I mean, what message are we trying to deliver? What ideas are we trying to sort of, you know, move? And try to deal with that as an uncomplicated manner as possible. I'm always frightened by the notion of speaking to a group of any size, and I guess I just assume that I'm the only one who knows what I'm going to say. So the quicker I say it and the clearer I say it, the better off I'm going to be. I think probably there was some preparation for this. In the role as assistant in the materials and research area, part of my responsibility was dealing with the results of broad tests and analysis of test data and the recommendations as to what ought to be done based on that data. In that context, we had an early opportunity to deal with technical groups. And there you're just reporting on a set of facts, here's what they suggest, here's what we recommend. And I can't say I've had any preparation for it. I'm not altogether sure I'm good at it. If there's a message to deliver, I mean, just do the best you can with it.
The period of time that you were active in leadership positions up to now in ESME, was an extremely important period in the political history of the United States and of different regions. How did you, and the necessity was that you get involved because of the Union. How did you enjoy that role?
Oh, very much so. I think the interaction with other labor leadership within the FL gives a chance to see how our ideas and views either paralleled or differed from. In the course of this role with him, we met governors and senators and congresspeople. He got a chance to get his view of who they were and what he thought about them. And not so much on a personal basis, but where they were on the issues that were important to us. Same is true of presidents. I found it, A, both exciting and quite useful in trying to give you some sense of what role you ought to play. I could pretty much tell whether or not Worf was going to support a political figure, you know, at the end of a meeting, and whether or not he was not going to support him, or at least, and he wasn't bashful about telling him, but he would want to think about it sometime, and I was pretty consistent with where he came out in the end. I think, again, for me personally, probably one of the luckiest folks around, because during this period we're talking about, lots and lots of things were happening, both in terms of domestic politics and policy and international stuff. And I think by being exposed to that, I was much better rounded for not only the job that I had, but for any other place I would go after that.
When you chaired or were head of this legislative and political action, was that the time?
Mm-hmm. Legislation and Community Affairs, they call it.
Community Affairs. Did you have responsibility for giving subsidies or assistance to candidates running for election, as many unions did?
I had the responsibility of recommending it.
Recommending it.
Yeah, yeah. In those days, we were much smaller. With a much smaller pot to deal with, but on the basis of where candidates and parties stood on issues important to the union or issues that we just philosophically agree with, you'd make a recommendation to the president, and he would decide, what do you want to do about it?
When it came to giving out the money or assigning it or notifying a candidate that you're supporting them, were you the one that did it?
No, in some cases yes, some cases no. I mean, he had a great belief in the fact that local people ought to be dealing with their representatives, and that if we're going to give help to an individual, local people ought to be a part of that process. And maybe sometimes the local person would give the check, or round up the volunteers, or become integrated into the campaign. But he would not leave them out. Some cases depended upon, you know, the national party thing, and he wanted to let it be very clear that he would do it. Some cases he would say, we pass this on to such and such with this letter. I mean, it varied over a lot, but the principal issue was he wanted local people to be identified with whatever support came from us.
In 1972, Joe Ames announced, or it was announced that Joe Ames was going to step down as Secretary Treasurer and take over as Administrator of the Judicial Panel, either a newly created organization or a newly defined.
The Judicial Panel was a part of the new Constitution,
right,
that was put together. It was just that the role was not a full-time role at that point, and we did not, when it was written in, understand the volume of business that it might get, because its jurisdiction was written out as elections and protests and all that kind of stuff. And in our union, I mean, people feel free to contest whatever they think is not right. So this the judicial panel was getting a big volume of work that in the eyes of both Joe and Jerry and possibly some others, it needed someone at headquarters on a full-time basis to coordinate the activities and keep the filing systems and all of that stuff, and sort of the precedents and history of all these different cases accurately filed and sorted out. Part of this had been the job of the lawyers, but there was real belief that the chair of this panel maybe ought to become a full-time responsibility. And the question then became who? And I think, I believe Joe came forward with this idea himself.
Yes, I believe that that's it. I think Jerry agreed with mm-hmm. that interpretation too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was this a surprise to the staff?
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
Step down as Secretary Treasurer.
I'm trying to think. Joe became Secretary Treasurer, I think, in about 66 or 67. I think he replaced Gordon Chapman. But he was still, because he felt so strongly about this judicial panel process, still doing a lot of the organizing and structuring. And it was becoming more and more work that to be done. And the travel of both that and responsibilities of the Secretary of Treasury, which was a good deal of travel also. I mean, I think he made a decision where he wanted to use most of his time. And I think it was quite a surprise to a lot of folks.
According to Joe Ames, as cited in Joe Golden's book, Jerry Wirth, Joe Ames indicated that he was the one that selected you to be the candidate for the Secretary of Treasury. Is that the procedure that you remember?
I can't say, because that discussion may have taken place somewhere else. I think I did have a conversation with both of them about it, but how the idea got translated from one to the other, I don't really know.
What was your initial reaction when you were approached? This meant running for election on the national level. How did you think about it?
Well, I was still mindful of this earlier lie that I had told about this being a one-year program, and I wasn't convinced that Washington D.C. was where I was going to sort of be forever. I was concerned about the implications for the union. You know, what does this mean? You know, and I was knowledgeable enough to know that there were no other African-American Secretary of Treasurers
right.
At that point in time. I mean, what's the message and what are we trying to do? I don't have any real problem in doing a token number if I know what it's about. And if you know what you're going to do is create a ballot, put Bill Lucy's name on it, and then we'll see how that fly. I'm not interested in that. But if folks think that by now you've made enough of a contribution to be worthy of this, even if it's a competitive thing, well, that has some possibility. But I want to be comfortable myself that this is serious. And I guess the question I asked Jerry when this question come up is, what are the implications for the union? If the union is not ready for this, and people are not willing to gauge you on the basis of where you've been and who you are, if folks are just going to take a look at a picture or a thing and turn off, and then there's not going to be the basic support for service that's needed to get over this hump. I'm not interested in doing that, because that just makes sure we're going to have a long-term problem. So I said to him, I mean, let me do my own sniffing. Let me make my own trips. Let me talk to people whose judgment we both value, see what they got to say. And not assuming they're going to tell you the truth when you ask them the first time. But at least you can look them in the eyeball and see, you know, how they react to it. We didn't make a decision, as I recall, right then, but we were going to get back together a couple of days, I mean, make some phone calls and see who else might think this is a good idea. That's what we did.
I understand that you traveled around the country to get a sense of public or the membership opinion.
Well, there were some people whose judgment, you really had to test. And this thing is the union ready for this kind of thing? And what's your reaction? What do you think the downsides and upsides are? And there were a lot of good people who would tell you what they think rather than what you want to hear. And I sort of wanted to have a chance to hear that, whether or not they thought the record was strong enough that it would stand, and would you support it in a contest with whoever? Most people thought that, hey, it's worth a shot. You know, if you're asking me, do I consider myself locked into it? No, but then you win me over in the debate. And I thought that was probably the most honest reaction you could get. I made sort of a loop around the country and talked to a lot of folks, and not just, you know, brand name leaders, but rank and filers who would be a part of the convention. And
did you go back to your California group at all, or were you able to contact them in different ways?
I went back to them. And they considered it a sellout, you know what I mean? But this was my group. it ain't enough that you're a pork chopper now. Now you're going to become a maximum pork chopper. they thought it was a good idea, but it ought to be won on the basis of ideas. It ought to be won on the basis of, engaging in a discussion about, you know, where Jerry and you would be trying to take the union,
right?
And recognizing that you're second voice in that discussion, but you know at least there's a reason for it. And I would say that Joe Ames is help and support can by no means be minimized. Clearly, Jerry's once he offered the thing was on board and was going to do what, but Joe, I think, did so much to give the whole issue credibility.
Yep, that's right. So you did finally, after careful consideration, make a decision to be the candidate. And this was an election in 1972.
Right.
Right. And that meeting was held at the National Convention.
Mm-hmm.
In what city was it?
Houston, Texas.
That's right. And how did that go about, the meeting?
Well, it was a regular convention.
The
election, like all of our conventions, the president is nominated first. And we did not know, nor was there any real effort made to keep anybody else from running. I mean, it's our convention, as you probably know. I mean, it's Freedom Hall. Anybody can jump up, as long as they're the paid-up member, they can run for office. So it wasn't a question of whether a brand name leader would run, but anybody else who, once the office was declared open, could run. I took the direction of, in terms of the nomination process, because it was, for this point in time, I thought very significant. So I asked a fellow by the name of Norm Scutt, from the state of Washington, who was, in my judgment, one of our most respected leaders. Philosophically, we may not have been in tune, but he was so well respected that if he was a part of this nominating process, it would give it, you know, good credibility. So I went to him and asked him if he would do it. To my surprise, he said he would be honored to do it. And he did. I mean, he gave such a glowing nominating speech that I believe some of the things he said myself. No, but it worked very well. There were other people who joined in the nominating thing. According to Joe, and for me, I'm just sitting there listening to all of this. He says, you know, the silence was deafening as we waited for further nominations. And you know, the Roberts Rule thing, you gotta wait for three calls. And this was about the longest period of time I had ever experienced. And when no other people were nominated, I mean, the convention sort of erupted in this sort of happy thing. I think the way we went about it collectively, A, did not take the membership of the convention for granted, and did not project this as anything other than a serious campaign for new and different office. And I think I, in all honesty, won some folks over because of color, lost some because of color. But the big hunk in the middle really believed that it would be a positive thing to have this happen.
What opportunity did you have once you decided to run or be a candidate? Did you have to express your views on the future of that union?
Oh, lots of them. Bearing in mind, I was at that time executive assistant. So meetings and conferences and special meetings, filling in for Jerry or whatever, gave you a chance to share views. And I go back to the point you raised about Jerry. Jerry was not afraid of folks having a different view than him. He certainly wasn't in favor of you trying to suggest the union go in some strange direction. But the ideas about what the union ought to be doing as a part of a broad agenda of items, he didn't have any fear with that. So when we were talking to big groups, New York or at that time Pennsylvania was getting fairly large, or Michigan or Ohio, the simple theory would tell folks what you think. I mean, there would be some who agree with you, there would be some who disagree with you. And
were there any specific issues at this convention? As there had been earlier, in terms of the union, different points of view.
I can't think of any other different points of views. I'll take that back. I mean, there had been some discussion about renaming the union, and while we didn't get into a big public debate about it, I for one didn't agree with it. I think Joe for two didn't agree with it, And while neither of us campaigned, we simply said it will not pay to push this issue. And we were so right. I mean, the resolution to introduce the name change went down the sewer and nothing flat. We were going to change it from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees to State, County, and Municipal Employees. And the acronym would be SCME, which would pronounce SCUMWA. So, we decided that wasn't going to go anywhere. We talked about laying the groundwork for a different financing system for the union. And every union convention per capita is always an issue. We proceeded to try and take out of the convention process this ongoing fight about financing. I mean, we didn't do it that meeting, but we certainly laid the groundwork for it so that the financing system ultimately, two conventions later, became automatic. It was tied to wage increases as opposed to, convention politics.
Well, in 1972 then, you had a new assignment, and that's the first African-American secretary-treasurer of any major international union. What did that do to your status? City of Washington. How did that new title, new responsibility change your responsibilities?
Well, I think the responsibilities changed in that you were now directly responsible for a a business piece of the union and a part of the elected leadership of the union. And I think both of those had, you know, some had different impact. I had always tried to be what I am. I mean, the title don't change that. And I think to a great degree, folks gave you credit for that. I had always, at least for the time being, I had been a part of the political process in the union. While one was not making the final decision, whether it's on a candidate or an issue or a program, you were part of the discussion. I just continued to be that. The responsibilities of the Secretary of Treasury in our union, and it may differ from union to union, as you're the principal financial officer of the union, and you're responsible to the board for giving them a clear picture of where the union stands financially, how its funds are being allocated in line with the budget that it adopts. So I then began my quarterly reporting to subordinate bodies and report to the membership on each meeting that it has on the financial status of the union. Auditing and responsibility, the monitoring of subordinate bodies and their, you know, fiduciary, you know, oversight of funds, and all of that's just part of the same package. We had never had the financial side of the union used in any political way, and we certainly weren't about to change that. So it was, for me, an easy transition. And in those days, you know, Jerry allowed for you to continue to the extent you wanted the broad contacts that you had with people and organizations that you had built relationships with. And he saw those to be ultimately beneficial to the union.
Did your relationship to Jerry change now that you're an elected key official with the union?
I don't believe so. I think it probably changed in some respects. He still saw it as, and I too, as a learning experience for me in a different way. Before you were taking on assignments that he gave you, now you had constitutional authorities and responsibilities of your own. I think he still saw himself as president, and therefore there's a relationship that has to exist if you're going to work together effectively. And I think that's the value of the prior experiences came into play there, because you just knew that, you know, conflict just won't work. He was president, and you had to recognize it, not that you had any difficulties with it. So for the years that we worked together were enjoyable years as far as I was concerned. I think we did some good things. We raised some serious issues. We gave support to some serious issues and projects.
I want to get in tomorrow to some of the more important issues that came up later in your career. But let me turn 1972. You helped found and form the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. In our previous filmed interview, we discussed that in more detail, but just for the sake of this context, now you're Secretary of Treasury, and this comes in. Did not the establishment of CBTU reflect in some instances, and certainly in some unions, that African American members were not given the proper recognition they deserved?
Oh, I think so. I think so. And I think virtually everybody recognized that fact. It wasn't a question of whether it was true. It was a question of what do you do about it.
Well, all right. I was leading. That's just a way of bringing it in. Here you are, Secretary Treasurer, and you're active in this movement, which has certainly some reflection upon the union you represented.
Mm-hmm.
Other unions more so, but how was this viewed? I don't think I've ever asked you before how Jerry Wirth viewed this and how other offices within AFSCME have viewed this.
I don't think I ever had more than one conversation with Jerry about it. Let me backtrack. At the AFL-CIO convention, and maybe even the convention of the Democratic Party, where all of this sort of came about, the black labor leadership who was there, who was outraged by the non-endorsement position and posture of the AFL-CIO. The question was, this is insane. And our decision was to find a way where our views were put into the process before a decision was made. Everybody was concerned what we had to say after they had made a decision. But there was no way to change the decision, no interest in changing it. But still, nobody suggested, well, in the future, here's what you ought to do. So we decided that this issue was large enough where we needed to find our own way to deal with it. So it wasn't, we didn't consult any of them as to whether or not we ought to do this. When we said what was going to happen, his comment, at least in the discussion I remember, the first was, where are you trying to go with this, and what are you trying to achieve? And at that point, the answer to both of those questions was, I don't know. But here is the problem. And once, we collectively began to talk about, the Charlie Hayes, and we started to see all of these other issues in a much brighter light that reflected this lack of status, this lack of input, this inability to affect decision making in the process. And he had no, his view was that there's very little that I can do to make these things happen. You got to row your own boat. And so we did. And he gave great support to it, without really knowing where we were trying to go. It did present, I think, some heartburn for him in one or two situations, particularly in the context of some of our differences with the AFL-CIO. I mean, he was on the executive council, and to the extent that I was a spokesperson for this other thing, the general view of the AFL-CIO is you tell your guy, to behave himself.
And that guy was you.
And that guy was me. And he never did that. He never came and says, well, here's what I want you to do on this issue. There were some very tricky issues that came up. And then the fact that folks were really trying to put us out of business early on put him in a very difficult, situation. But he never said, you ought to stop this. You ought to do it. He never once said, I want to come to a meeting and tell you what I think. He recognized that all of the people who were participating in this were serious trade unionists, and were not going to play any race game that would jeopardize the integrity of their union. I could get every black vote in our union and lose by a landslide, so it's not an issue where you're mobilizing black workers against the establishment. That's silly. The only difference we had was on one occasion where he wanted me to take a position on something that I didn't want to take a position on, and so I didn't. And he says that you would think after all we've been through, you'd do this one thing. I said, well, that one thing is inconsistent with what I think. And he didn't argue about it. It was inconsistent with what I thought, but it was consistent with what he thought. So. He never said anything else about it.
Were you put under any pressure from other people in the labor movement in this particular aspect of CBTU?
I think there were other international union leadership who put pressure on their people to isolate us. They tried to suggest that we were somewhere out of the mainstream, that we were so far left of center that we were not to be considered a part of the movement. And, you know, for some of us, these things kind of held some difficulty and kind of hurt, because most of us, if not all of us, had really spent a lifetime, you know, advocating, you know, sound trade union policies. And all of a sudden, because you might have a difference with the AFL-CIO as a structure, all of a sudden folks got to be leery of you. And we had these debates, you know, and discussions with the AFL-CIO. In a very strange way, we had a better relationship with Mr. Meany than we had with the AFL-CIO staff. I mean, he says, you know, I may disagree with you, but you guys got an obligation to argue your issue. And he says, in his exact words from one meeting, he says, I do not have the capacity to change tradition. And at that time, we were discussing, you know, the question of black leadership at the executive council level and within the AFL-CIO structures, not just headquarters, but central labor bodies and state federations, et cetera. He says that the only way leadership can come onto the council is with the acceptance of the other presidents, and you certainly weren't going to get anybody on the council whose president was not on the council, or whose president disagreed with you coming on the council. Well, he said, well, then our response was, then how do you think this process ever changes? He says it may never change.
Were there any basic issues that you favored and supported on behalf of CBTU that were inconsistent with the objectives of policies of ASME, such as membership? Not the broad issues of diversity and the like, but enlarging the AFL-CIO Council, for example, of memberships for minorities automatically on the council, things like that.
I would not know whether or not there was disagreement with it. All I would know is whether or not we had a conversation about one's feeling about it. I strongly favored, for many years, urban organizing. You know, meaning cities and counties as opposed to states. Because the ability to organize around issues broader than just workplace issues were there. And our history had shown that we can organize in New York City, we can organize in Philadelphia, we can organize a Cleveland or a Detroit, because the bulk of the people you're going to be organizing can identify with a broader agenda. And this argument held for a while, and then Jerry decided that our future lied in state service. And that we were going to drift in that direction. And we argued a little bit about that. And while the National Union, we had no defined entity who was responsible for organizing. So if we were going to take on state government, that was clearly going to be a national union responsibility.
Right.
Whereas local government was a combined responsibility that we could do, in my opinion, from an economic point of view, much more effectively. Our political strength would grow proportionate to our ability to organize. And he listened and thought it was a great argument and went right ahead and did what he wanted to do. I think we probably, we didn't differ on the issue, but differed on the timing of what we do about the South. And there's no ability to say who was right or wrong on that.
I think this is a good time, Carolyn, to stop for today. I'd like to spend a minute with Bill, if I could, about tomorrow, and see what his ideas might be on We should come. This is January 11th, 2002. We're continuing with the oral history interview with William Lucy. Bill, is a follow-up to yesterday, taking the period from 1972 to 1981, when you became Secretary of Treasury. Some of the basic issues or major issues facing AFSCME and in which you were involved and had to deal with. Let's start off with the whole issue of the Vietnam War. What impact did that have upon the Union and you?
I think the Vietnam War period was a time of I guess great inward looking, because our union, as you all know, is a fairly conservative union. I mean, it's made up of public sector workers from all over the spectrum, people who are very, very patriotic, people who are very, very committed to the goals and objectives of the nation and certainly the nation's administration. But a large segment of our union was conflicted by the war itself. I mean, we were not convinced that it was a popular war. One, it was a war where our, what I would call our tangible national interests was involved. And as a result, there was a great debate taking place in the union as to whether to blindly support the administration, in spite of the fact that some very good people were at the forefront of the buildup in Vietnam. I, along with others, thought it was not a war that was, in the best interest of the country, nor had we been sufficiently informed as to all of the factors that went into our involvement. And that debate consumed a good deal of the union's energy. President Wirth was also conflicted, although quite committed to the goals of our country, quite committed to the principles of the AFL-CIO, fundamentally thought that this was not a war that didn't need a lot more debate and discussion. But secondly, and I think much more importantly, the amount of resources that had to be committed on a build-up basis to that effort began to have its impact on public sector budgets. To the extent that federal dollars, federal programs had to be down-funded in order to increase the military budget for that specific purpose was another source of great debate. And we began to talk about what could be done if those resources were directed to domestic problems, problems of education, of health, of housing, of jobs, of roads. It became very clear that there was a priority question that had not been resolved anywhere in this debate. And internal to our union, that issue began to resonate among the members, you know, moderates, conservatives, what have you. The impact that the war was having on domestic programs and domestic spending. And that debate went on for a number of years. And we attempted on occasion to see whether or not we wanted to have some process by which we could get a sense of the union as to what position the union ought to take in support of or opposition to. Many of the leaders individually were opposed to the war, and many were supportive of the effort. But I think what triggered our real movement towards out-and-out opposition was the incursion into Cambodia and the surrounding countries, the bombing that was unleashed by the Nixon administration. I forget what year, but any event, I mean, just out of the blue. And there was no declared war. I mean, it was just such an outrage. I believe in convention, our delegates voted almost unanimously to oppose our involvement in that war. And this caused us a great deal of problems, certainly within the AFL-CIO. I think the board and President Wirth and we felt it was time that at least our voices be heard in this debate. And I think we were on the right side of history. We may have been a little bit late in getting there, but eventually we made the transition. And as history has shown, the country is still not clear what the war was about, our involvement. What is clear is that the economic interests were certainly the controlling direction. Those who so actively supported our engagement in opposition to the Vietnam governments and leadership are back there now, you know, by the hundreds doing business in an environment that they said was so, you know, morally wrong. So, I mean, it raised a number of questions. We're now 50,000 lives later, if not more, and we're doing business as usual with who we said was our forever enemy. So we think our union played a positive role in allowing our membership to move to the point where it understood what the issue was and gave us the direction to voice our position.
Now, you've described the internal dispute or the dispute within the union and the membership in trying to arrive at a widely accepted policy and allowing the membership to have a role in it. What pressures were put on you by George Meany and the AFL-CIO to take a different stand?
Well, I'm sure that there were discussions that took place between Mr. Meany and President Wirth, which I was not privy to, but certainly the common, I guess, strategy was isolation or not having access to all that you may have been entitled to as a major affiliate. I never heard Jerry say that there was any clash of ideas between him and President Meany, but certainly his ability to take a seat on the Executive Council early on was a factor in this. And I think Jerry went through a great deal of thought, you know, weighing those two things. Can I do a more effective job on the council? Do I be so outwardly expressive of my views? And he went through a great deal of self-searching. And, you know, some says that he was not as actively engaged in the debate as he could have been or should have been in the interest of trying to gain the seat on the Executive Council. Eventually, he did both things. He received he got the seat, and I think was an active advocate of our union's, you know, posture while he was there.
Did your position you took on Vietnam affect you in any way in terms of the growth of the union around the country?
I think it probably helped us. I think in the public sector, those people who we were organizing were first of all coming into the realization that they, as public sector employees, had not and were not being dealt with fairly by the systems under which they work. So just the idea of collective bargaining in an aggressive union was okay. And I think they respected the views that we held and expressed on major public policy questions, the Vietnam War being one of them. Nobody was surprised about what we stood for. And in many cases, even if they disagreed with us on some of the policy questions, they believed that we were aggressive enough to represent their interests at the workplace and would do it equally as strong. So I think we gained a lot of credibility. In those years, we were being successful in organizing campaigns like no union had ever experienced before. We were averaging probably 55,000 net new members per year. And this was an exciting period of time. At the 64 elections, we had as a membership count about 275, maybe 300,000 members nationwide. By the time we hit the middle 70s, we were approaching 600, 650, 700,000 members and still growing. And I think this was not only due to Jerry's sort of aggressive pursuit of fairness for public sector workers, but he was an outspoken advocate for new ideas and new and creative approaches to issues. And I think we benefit from it.
Now, on the FFL-CIO, they AFSCME was certainly one of the major unions to campaign for a special department representing public employees.
Right, right.
Long struggle with Mr. Meany about this. Just tell us about this.
Well, you know, historically, the FLCIO has been fairly narrow in its view as to what sectors of the workforce were important. In those days, the bill and trades section of the FLCIO had power far beyond its numbers. Its philosophy, you know, permeated the organization, not arguing whether it's good or bad, but I mean, it was a bill and trades philosophy. The industrial union side, certainly as reflected in the views of Walter Reuther and others, was not, you know, in the top echelons. We held a view that was much closer to the industrial unions than to the building and construction trades. And the AFL did not see the public sector as a real place where growth was going to take place. As a matter of fact, in those days, it was not AFL-CIO concern as to whether growth did or did not take place. They didn't see themselves as responsible for organizing a workforce, nor did they have the capacity to do it. So Jerry's view was that unless we had a department whose special responsibility was to focus on the issues of public sector workers, we and the other, you know, smaller unions were never going to make it in the arena of A, public policy, and B, convincing the public sector workforce that trade unionism was the path it ought to take. So we began to argue for a public employee department. And we were kind of lone voices in that debate, because a department is a budget question, first of all. Industrial unions were still fighting their battle to find their place in the sun, and the bill and trades had no particular interest. But we did have a couple of good allies. Certainly Paul Hall was an ally, and Reuther was an ally, but as I said, they had their own issues. We could not, for a number of years, get attention paid to the specific issue of the department. So we formed some relationships with other groups, AFGE. We formed a relationship with the National Education Association, trying to bring large groups of public sector employees together to work on common issues. We formed something called CAPE. I think it was the Coalition of American Public Employees, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, James Farmer was its first executive director, and it began to push, you know, the issues of public employees, and I think the existence of CAPE, along with a shift in some thinking, was the impetus for the AFL-CIO beginning to look at the question of public employees. And because AFGE, the AFT, and several others were active in the AFL-CIO, once we formed this thing outside, it became important that there be an alternative to it inside. And I don't recall the year, but eventually the department was chartered as a full department. But the interesting thing is that the affiliation was allowed for all members of the FLCIO. So you could be an industrial union but still belong to the public employee department. Whereas if you were not a building trades union, you could not join the building construction trades department. So one way of meeting the request but watering down the impact was to allow non-public sector unions to participate in the policy process for public sector unions. So the principal issue that concerned us, collective bargaining rights, could not be purely advocated by a department whose mission it was to work for public employees. We could not get a resolution or a policy proposed by the public employee because the non-public employees were opposed to the issue. You understand what I mean?
Yes, I do.
So it was complicated from the start.
Well, it had another complication. For example, when the AFT was not enthusiastic for this department, but you formed an alliance with the NEA,
right,
which
right.
was outside of,
right, right.
of the AFL-CIO.
Right, and I think it added great pressure to force, I believe either David Selden or Al Shanker, I don't recall which one was
Selden
president.
Selden was president, and Shanker would have been vice president
right.
then, so they both.
Right. They then, at the point, joined with us and the AFGE and said maybe the time has come. But as I said, they granted the request, but then made membership open to all affiliates, which meant that you had just one more department that was acting like every other department, not specifically on behalf of public sector employee issues. And what was so very interesting is that we were never able to get a recommendation from that department for a federal collective bargaining law for public employees.
Right.
I mean, that law came from the Maritime Trades Department, which is one of the great contradictions.